Hi there, I'm Gary Middleholtz in St. John, and this is the Maritimes This Week. We're doing something a little different on the podcast this week. We're getting out of the studio, and that's the great thing about podcasting, because you can do it from anywhere. So I thought I'd come here to the St. John City Market. I'm going to give you a 30-second history lesson. It was first opened in 1876 and survived the Great Fire of 1877, just a year later. The market is a full city block in length, and at both entrances hang the same wrought iron gates that have swung closed at the end of each business day since 1880. Now, the people who built this place back then were shipbuilders, and if you look up, you'll see it resembles the inverted hull of a ship. Now, the best thing about the market is the food. There are bakers and butchers and fishmongers, sandwiches you'd die for. The smells in here are incredible, and I'm getting hungry just being here. Okay, so that's your history lesson. On with the podcast. Coming up today, a project of cosmic proportions.
If we're going to keep Pluto, and Pluto's now a dwarf planet, then the logical solution is to add dwarf planets and incorporate them into the existing main solar system model.
A man in the state of Maine built a 40-mile-long scale model of the solar system. Now, that was before Pluto was demoted to a dwarf planet. We'll find out why that means the main model is growing, not shrinking. Also today, part two in our series, Adieu L'Acadie, Hello Alberta.
Today with the smaller families, you know, it leaves a big void in the community if the children of a particular family leave.
As Acadians leave for jobs in the West, we'll look at the impact that's having here at home. Coming up first, a story that'll make us think and ask ourselves, what would I have done in that person's shoes? You're about to meet Charlie Richard. He's a trucker from Rogersville, New Brunswick, and until now he's been keeping quiet about something that happened to him this summer. Of course, he told some friends, and, well, you know what happens when you do that. It gets around. The CBC's Sean Waters heard about Charlie's story and invited him to drop by our studios. He asked Charlie Richard to start his story from the beginning.
It was Monday morning. I had an appointment at the dentist in Moncton. So me and my wife and my little daughter, we headed up to Moncton and went for my dentist appointment. And after that was done, we did a few errands around Moncton and stuff. And then on the way back from Moncton, we were on our way home towards Rogersville, I guess. And when we got to Harcourt, we were driving through Harcourt, and I looked over to the left where the tracks were going by, and I seen this truck with a piece of machinery on it. And then I said to Linda, I says, boys, that truck looks like it's stuck on the tracks here. So anyways, I turned the car around and went to see what was going on, because I drive truck too, so I figured I could lend a guy a hand or something. So I got out of the car and I went and seen the guy, and I asked him, I says, are you stuck on the, you know, on the tracks or something? He says, yeah.
How would you know it was stuck on the track?
Well, it was like a low bed float, they call it. That's kind of like a trailer that hauls machinery. And it's low to the ground. And when he went over the tracks, there's kind of like the tracks kind of like higher than the road. And so when he went over the crossing, the float got wedged up on the tracks. Yeah, it was wedged right over the tracks. Like the wheels of the truck weren't even hardly... He was just spinning like in no traction whatsoever, huh? And what happened, actually, the guy was supposed to go over a crossing that was down the road about 1,000 feet, but he took the wrong crossing, and that's why he got stuck on the tracks. So then, anyways, I asked the guy, I said, you're stuck? He said, yeah. And then I looked up the tracks, and I seen this light. And it's kind of tricky, too, because the train runs parallel with the Route 126, so it could have been a car or something, huh? But it kind of looked like a big bright light like the trains have. So anyways, I said to him, I said, that looks like the train. And he says, no, I don't think that looks like the train. So then the contractor that owned the piece of equipment and the truck, he showed up. So I walked over to him and I said, I think the train's coming. He said to me, he said, no, he says the Via Rail would have gone by now. And so I said to him, well, maybe you should come over and take a look with me and And I think it's the train. So he stepped up over on the tracks with me, and he said, yeah, I think that's the train coming.
He was that calm?
He was pretty calm, yeah, because I don't think he knew the train was coming, because the train was running about an hour late. And as soon as them words were spoken, I was gone to the car. And I jumped in the car, and my wife Linda thought we were running away from the train. Like, I was stopped on, like, on the side of the 126 where the truck was stuck. And so anyways, I left there, and I drove pretty fast down to the next crossing, because I know the area pretty good. It's about, oh, it's a quite a good drive down to the next crossing anyways. So I got down to the next crossing, and I jumped out of the car. And when I got there, the lights they have at the crossings there, they were flashing. And I got out of the car, and the train was coming across. There's a bridge there just before that set of rail tracks. The train was coming across the via rail. And I waved and waved and waved as much as I could.
You stood on the tracks and waved?
Well, at first I was standing in the tracks, but as soon as the train started to get closer and closer, I kind of moved over. But I was waving pretty good there. I was doing like jumping jacks, anything to get his attention of the conductor there. So, and when the train went by me, I could hear it kind of slowing down. So they probably thought at first that I was going to commit suicide or something, jump in front of the train or something, you know, kill myself. But anyway, as soon as they saw that I didn't do anything, well, I think they kind of clued in that there was something going on. And got back in the car, went down to the next crossing, and the train stopped about 1,000 feet from the truck.
You're kidding.
And the worst thing about it, that float is a heavy piece of machinery. It's solid steel, and the machine that he was hauling, it was a big machine. And if that via rail would have rammed into that float and the machine, I wouldn't want to. Would have been a disaster, you know. It was the passenger train, the via train that runs from Montreal to Halifax. I talked to the train engineer, and he kind of thanked me that it was there waving them down. So they sent me a letter to thank me for doing a good deed, I guess. The via rail sent me a letter. It thanked me for doing a good deed, for being there, and it confirmed the names of the engineers. I can't think of their names right now. Just to say that I was there to help out for what could have been a major disaster.
But you're humble. You don't want any reward out of this.
No, I'm just happy that I was able to help out. If you see something on the road, you gotta think that it could be you in their place. So I know a lot of people are in a rush nowadays. Everybody seems to be in a hurry to get somewhere. So if you can help out.
So you didn't get a reward?
No.
No reward.
No reward, no. I actually live a pretty happy lifestyle now. I work and have a great family, and I couldn't ask for better.
What do you think when you cross railway tracks now? Do you think about it when you cross railway tracks?
I've talked to a fellow that works on the rail, and he told me that it takes 3/4 of a mile to stop a V-rail train with dynamic brakes. And also the train runs at 70 miles an hour through Harcourt. So by the time they would have seen the truck and everything going on, if they would have pulled the brakes, I think it would have been too late to stop.
Well, Charlie, congratulations for doing it. I think you're a hero. We need more people like you.
Thank you very much.
So I hope your boss is listening to this and gives you a big fat raise. All right. Thank you very much, Charlie, for coming in.
That's Charlie Richard of Rogersville, New Brunswick, speaking with the CBC's Sean Waters. Sure does make you think, doesn't it? What would you have done in a situation like that? You're listening to The Maritimes This Week, a podcast featuring the best of CBC Radio 1 programming from Nova Scotia, PEI, and New Brunswick. I'm Gary Middleholtz at the City Market in St. John, where people all around me are eating. It smells so good in here, my stomach is starting to rumble. Up next, we're going to leave the Maritimes and travel to a galaxy far away. Well, actually, just our solar system. Well, really, it's just next door in the state of Maine, but it seems a long way away. Kevin McCarthy has taken on a renovation project of cosmic proportions. McCartney is the man behind a 40-mile-long scale model of the solar system. Earlier this summer, astronomers reclassified Pluto, saying it could no longer be considered a planet. But McCartney's solar system isn't shrinking, it's growing. CBC reporter Jacques Poitras joined McCartney on a visit to Pluto and beyond.
There she be.
Kevin McCartney pauses to acknowledge a tiny scale model of Pluto and its moon Charon in a display case in the Tourism Information Center in Holton, Maine.
Hello, how are you doing?
Great, how are you?
Pretty good, just checking to see how things are going here.
The one-inch sphere is part of a 40-mile-long scale model of the solar system that runs along Highway 1. The problem is, back in August, astronomers voted to reclassify the real Pluto as a dwarf planet, not a planet. The staff here at the Tourism Center have been wondering what will happen to their little Pluto. McCartney has good news for them. Pluto gets to stay.
We are in the process of incorporating dwarf planets to the solar system model. We're going to have, as three dwarf planets have just been accepted.
As fascinating as the science is to State of Maine employee Heidi Wilson, she's more concerned with practical matters, such as what to tell the tourists.
When were the brochures going to be done?
We were just getting ready to reprint the brochures when the announcement for Pluto. Actually, as soon as I know where these dwarf planets are going to be, I'd like to, because we're running out of brochures.
Right, yeah, I'm all out.
And you're all out. We are out, too.
Wilson's having a hard time keeping up with all the tourists coming to see the solar system model. Tourists such as Bill and Kathy Attic from southern Maine.
The one that we just saw, Neptune, was it Neptune? That was fairly large.
The Attics started their trip with the Sun, located 40 miles from here at the University of Maine at Presque Isle, where Kevin McCartney teaches geology. They saw the models of the four planets that are closest to the Sun in the real solar system, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. In this model, they're all on campus or in Presque Isle.
It was just a fun thing to do. Once we spotted the first one, then it keeps you going to find the others.
The remaining planets in the model are on poles along Highway 1, heading south to Holton. Their distances from the Sun are to scale, and so are their sizes. The biggest, Jupiter, is 5 feet wide. The smallest, Pluto, here in Holton, is the size of a large gumball. Speaking of which, Bill and Kathy Attic are not happy about Pluto's recent demotion.
I don't understand why it still can't be a planet. If they're going to reclassify that, they might have to reclassify lots of other things.
And we're old enough now that we're going to keep it as a planet in our lives. You know, we're at that stage in our lives. We're keeping it as a planet. We really don't care what they decide to do.
Even State of Maine employee Heidi Wilson admits she can't be objective when it comes to Pluto.
It's kind of my baby. I was glad they weren't going to take it down because, you know, we take care of it for them and everything. So we like it here and stuff, so...
Kevin McCartney continues south on Highway 1, heading for the outer fringes of his solar system. He's looking for a home for another dwarf planet, UB313, which was recently officially named Eris. McCartney says he has to be scientifically consistent.
Obviously, we're not going to take Pluto down. If we're going to keep Pluto, and Pluto's now a dwarf planet, then the logical solution is to add dwarf planets that are of at least a size, Pluto size, more or less, that can be seen on the roadside and incorporate them into the existing main solar system model.
So for McCartney, just 3 years after finishing the nine-planet model, built with a budget of zero and a lot of community volunteers, he's back at work.
First of all, you have to deal with landowners and ask if we can put a planet there. The planet itself needs a concrete base and a metal pole that would be 11 feet off the ground, several feet into the ground.
Boy, that was a long drive, wasn't it? Eris is a long ways past Pluto.
In fact, dwarf planet Eris is twice as far from the Sun as Pluto. On a Maine Highway 1 scale, that would put it here, in Topsfield, Maine, population 235.
Knock, knock.
Knock, knock.
Are you Eva?
Yes, I am.
Hi, I'm Kevin. I hope you don't mind if I bring...
McCartney has come to meet Topsfield's town administrator, Eva Severance.
Well, we're the mileage is about right. A little further down would be perfect, but anywhere around here... What we're looking for.
Severance has a couple of possible locations to show McCartney, whose enthusiasm is palpable.
This might bring a few tourists up to the area. It's amazing what a little dwarf planet can do.
It seems like over there looks better, doesn't it? Even if it's a little further from Route 1.
Severance and McCartney take a look at a patch of land at the corner of Highway 1 and Highway 6, an intersection many New Brunswickers cross while driving from the border at McAdam to the I-95. McCartney declares the site ideal, easy to find, with good sight lines, and some obvious landmarks tourists can use to find it, a church, a gas station, and a war memorial.
I'm thinking right about where we're standing, right here, would be a good spot.
Just like that, the decision is made, and McCartney launches into what happens next.
And then we'll come down probably with a Loring Job Corps crew of kids, and dig a hole, set the post in, the base in.
Severance says she expects no hassles from the state government, which owns the land at the corner. She herself can't wait for Topsfield to take its place in the solar system.
I have looked at the planets going up through and thought it was sort of a fun project, and it's something that a lot of the school children enjoy going up through and looking at, and I thought it would be sort of nice.
McCartney relaxes for a moment at the town hall. He's very satisfied Eris has a home. But given the pace of astronomical discovery, he doubts he can sit still for long. He says Topsfield is unlikely to be the end of the road, solar system-wise, for very long.
We used to have a solar system model that was 40 miles, and of course the solar system model was tucked up into the northeast part of the state, and now with these dwarf planets, I suspect that we're, as the years go by and more of these things are discovered, we'll probably have some dwarf planets scattered, you know, throughout the state.
You might say that here on the American side of the Maine-New Brunswick border, the universe is unfolding as it should. In Topsfield, Maine, I'm Jacques Poitras.
And if you're interested in checking out the Maine Solar System model, there's a map and photographs on Kevin McCartney's website. Just type in Maine Solar System model, type it into Google, and the first link will take you right there. Now, part two in our series, Adieu L'Acadie, Hello Alberta. In the past 18 months, more than 150 people from the Acadian municipality of Clare in southwestern Nova Scotia and at least 50 Acadians from Cheticamp in Cape Breton have moved west in search of high-paying jobs. They are lobster fishermen, tradespeople, and fish plant workers out of work and out of opportunities in Nova Scotia. Some can make more money in a week in Alberta than they can make in a month back home. What do these Acadian migrants of all ages find in Alberta? And how do they adapt to a way of life and a cultural environment very different from their rural Acadian communities? Radio Canada journalist Fernand DeVoe took a plane to Alberta this summer to find out.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Halifax, where the local time is approximately 6:30.
After a four-hour flight from Calgary, travelers are weary. Some of them are Acadian migrants who still have a three-hour drive home to Clare or Cheticamp. These days, many Acadians go back and forth every few months, but others have moved out west for good with their young families. That trend worries business people like Paul-Émile Leblanc, the general manager of the Caisse Populaire de Clare.
Well, of course, here in the Clare area, the biggest impact would be the loss of their retail spend when they live out west. If a family of two or four move away, well, you know, there's groceries, there's gas, mortgage payments or rental payments. I mean, their whole family budget gets lost to your community because that money is being spent in another community out west. So if you take that out of your economy and if you've lost, let's say, 100 people, well, that can be a significant amount of money out of your economy. And that affects everybody because it can affect other jobs in the rest of the community.
At IFTDO Shipbuilding, a worker is polishing a propeller, but Marine Superintendent Everett Titus is concerned about losing momentum.
In the past year to about a year and a half, we've lost between 35 to 40 that have moved on from here and have moved out west.
They include highly specialized tradespeople, like experienced aluminum welders, who are very difficult to replace. The company has lost more than a quarter of its workers, and that has made tendering more complicated.
There are some projects that we certainly looked at, and we felt that if we were to bid these jobs and get them, that we would not be able to deliver on time. And some of these projects that we looked at, we have had to sort of let them go by.
And while workers are building a million-dollar yacht for an American customer, Everett Titus fears for the future of Clare's Acadian community.
Because all these young people going out, maybe 25% may come back. The remainder of the 75%, and this is only in my mind, may stay over there. So, in effect, the community in this area here is certainly not growing.
Bienvenue à tout le monde qui nous écoute de la région locale ici à Chéticamp, Saint-Jean-de-Bois et Magri.
In Cape Breton, the president of the Chéticamp Development Commission, Jean Chiasson, is also concerned.
I hate to say it, but the economy is going to suffer for a while. I hope it'll rebound in the next 3 or 4 years and stabilize, that will keep the people we have. But it's very, very mind-boggling of what could happen if the people keep going away at this rate. In 2 or 3 years, we could have only retired people, school teachers and hospital workers in Chéticamp, except for the fishermen themselves.
Jean Chiasson thinks the exodus to the West is fueled by the uncertainty in the fishing industry.
The fishery used to give you 6 to 7 months' work, where now if you work in a fish plant, it's anywhere from 12 to 16 weeks. It leaves a long year waiting and too much time to think about moving away, as far as I'm concerned, including myself.
Back in her office in Edmonton, Suzanne Corneau helps Acadian migrants find work in Alberta. She's heard about the plight of the Acadian communities in the Maritimes.
Moi, je trouve ça triste pour la communauté acadienne. Je trouve ça triste qui...
I know there are ghost towns in the making in Acadia. It's sad for the Acadian community, but you can't blame the Acadians seeking year-round employment. You can't blame them. Acadian migrants have told me, we used to survive in Acadia, now we're living.
Nous, on survivait en Acadie, maintenant on vit.
Nevertheless, people like Paul-Émile Leblanc and Clare believe the Acadian communities can weather this perfect storm.
Definitely, like, we've existed for 400 years, and I'm always amazed at how we have survived and that our community still exists. And I think this is another challenge in that long plight since coming to North America.
I think that individually people are realizing more and more. Unfortunately, I don't think there has been a collective and conscious awareness of what's happening.
Paul Comeau runs a restaurant in Clare. He believes this exodus from L'Acadie is unlike any other.
There were large families, so if half of the family went away, half stayed behind and worked on the farm or continued the fishing operations. So there were enough people then to probably do both, maintain a dynamic community and have family members away earning extra money. I think that today with the smaller families, you know, it leaves a big void in the community if the children of a particular family leave.
Different because the population of the municipality of Clare is already in decline. Nearly 10,000 people lived here in 1986. During the next decade, 1,000 left the area. Today, only 6,000 people still speak French in Clare. Polkomo wonders how the only officially French municipality in Nova Scotia will hang on to its soul.
I think it will have a disastrous effect on the community. We're going to end up with a community of seniors, and that's fine. We need seniors in our communities. But at the same time, when you look at the perspectives of having these young families leave, it has an impact on schools, it has impact on services, on facilities for the community. And add on to that, that cultural mix of being Acadian and having, a French-speaking community, I think that will have a tremendous negative impact on the survival as a distinct cultural and linguistic community.
What can Acadian communities do to counter this exodus to Alberta? The young president of the Clare Chamber of Commerce, Marc Robichaud, thinks one thing could reverse the trend.
We need to find oil in St. Mary's Bay. Diversify. We need to think what could replace big industries that are disappearing. Should we invest in aquaculture, renewable energy? How do we reinvent ourselves?
Ryan Vacon, a welder from Clare who works in Alberta, has some suggestions.
Well, I think they need to switch around the industry a little bit. We're concentrating on some really old ways of, well, we've been doing this for so long, we can't do anything else. But a lot of the things we build out here, like mud tanks and the trucks and everything like that, can be built in a relatively small shop. So you could build that, in Matagan, in Shelburne, in Halifax, and any really small community, because a lot of them get shipped down to Halifax to be sent overseas. So if we can build them there, we can cut the cost and we can still pay the same wages that they pay out here.
In Clare, Marc Robichaud thinks a more feasible idea is to promote the quality of life in rural Nova Scotia.
I don't think we'll ever compete with the dollars that they're paying, but it's a trade-off between the lifestyle. This is a nice rural community. It's a great place to live. We'll never be able to be competitive with offering, the same salaries or the same wages as what they offer out west. We certainly can be competitive with offering something decent to live in a rural area.
The average income in Acadian communities in Nova Scotia is between $19,000 and $25,000 a year, and a number of business people feel that the salaries offered are good enough considering the cost of living in rural areas. Polkomo disagrees.
I can't understand fully that phrase, it's good enough, after all, we're in Clare, and that should be sufficient to live on for here. The problem with that statement is that people living in Clare have the same assessment of their properties as the ones living in Halifax or elsewhere in the province. We don't get a break when we buy home heating fuels, electrical rates. It's not because we live in this particular part of the province that we're going to pay lower electrical rates because we're poor.
Polkomo suggests business people in Clare have to change the way they see and do things.
In the past, they haven't had the greatest reputation in terms of encouraging other companies to come into the area, fearing that it would increase what salaries are paid to workers in the community. But again, if one wants to stay in business today, can companies in Clare or anywhere else in rural Nova Scotia afford not to increase what they pay to their workers? If you bid on a job, you might as well accept that labor cost is a legitimate expense that can be worked into that particular contract.
While Acadian communities are wondering how to diversify their economy, a provincial agency has just launched a campaign in Alberta to attract companies to Nova Scotia. The province hopes that some businesses from the West will choose to set up in rural Nova Scotia. Polkomo would like that as well, but he thinks it will be a challenge for some areas like Clare.
We have to look at the fundamental requirements to entice companies to come and establish themselves in southwestern Nova Scotia and in particular in Clare. We have no infrastructure. We've eliminated air transportation. We don't even have public transportation in the area. So we have a long, long ways to go, and somebody has to become the architect of the economic renewal and revival in rural Nova Scotia.
Acadians have lived in this part of the world for 400 years, but the economic and social challenges they face by the exodus to the West are profound. The vibrant language and culture that have sustained them throughout the centuries are being tested one more time.
We'll have part three of the series next week on the podcast. Well, that's it for this edition of the Maritimes This Week, a podcast featuring the best of CBC radio programming from the East Coast. Now, if you'd like to comment on anything you've heard on the podcast, feel free to contact us at cbc.ca/podcasting. All CBC podcasts are available from cbc.ca. Click on podcast or go to iTunes for a download. I'm Gary Middleholtz in St. John. Thanks for clicking and downloading us this week. Now, I'm at the historic Old City Market in St. John, New Brunswick, and I'm starved. I hate to eat and run, but I gotta go. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye. All right, how about a roast beef on a Kaiser?
You got it, man. You want some cheese, some onions with that? Anything else?
How about a pickle?
A pickle? Okay, and I'll throw a little bit of hot sauce on there for you, too.
Oh, okay, Gary? Lovely. I'm hungry. Thanks.
Hey, man. Just be a second.